Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
We welcome you to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. I hope everyone is having a great Labor Day weekend so far as we launch this during the middle of Labor Day weekend, and we hope everyone's travels are safe. Certainly, we hope that those that get a day off are enjoying the day off, and we are a retail podcast. We know a lot in the retail industry don't get Labor Day off, and certainly thinking about them and very appreciative of everyone's efforts in the retail industry, especially during such a busy shopping holiday. Well, coming up on today's show, we'll be joined by Mike Welsh, the Chief Creative Officer of Mobiquity. It's an interesting conversation because we're going to talk about app-based loyalty programs, specifically as it pertains to convenience stores. We don't talk about convenience stores a lot in the interview segments of our podcast. It'll change today as Mike Welsh has a lot of great insights. It was a fantastic conversation and certainly appreciative that he took the time to join us here to talk about those particular programs. By the way, Mobiquity has among its clients Come and Go and Wawa, who are major C-store players, whether you're on the East Coast or in the Midwest for each of those chains. We'll also talk just a little bit about more cashierless stores potentially launching, but we'll lead off with Duluth Holdings sales numbers as we previewed in our show during the middle of this last week. A quick reminder that you can check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. We just uploaded more pictures on Instagram from my trip through the Dakotas and Montana, and we'll continue to upload those throughout the next couple of weeks. You can also like us, rate us, however you do access us. If you enjoy the show, your ratings help others to find us, and those certainly do help. So as we talked about, we're going to lead off with Duluth Holdings, most notably known in the retail industry, of course, as Duluth Trading Company. The prevailing question coming into the earnings call: could Duluth, given their fairly mature e-commerce presence, buck the trend of most apparel retailers who have largely seen down results in the times of the pandemic? The short answer was yes, at least as far as their bottom line was concerned. There were ups and downs, positives and negatives to the quarter, and we'll break down all of those. Analysts expected diluted earnings per share of 5 cents. Duluth Holdings earnings per share numbers instead came in at 18 cents. Per share, and that's a substantial beat. And although their sales numbers were generally good, as we mentioned, not all was positive for the retailer. They remain bullish regarding their brick and mortar expansion, but store closures, not permanent closures, but closures due to the pandemic and local regulations during the second quarter, did cost their brick and mortar division. Some stores were able to reopen as early as the first week in May. Some could only reopen as early as the third week in June. As a result, their retail store net sales sagged by 40.4% year over year, despite the slew of new store openings during that span, not so much recently. We'll talk about that here in a second. Because of their relatively low store count overall, again, you're still looking at under 70 stores for Duluth Trading Company. They continued to be hesitant to disclose comp sales, basically just kept their commentary to year-over-year division net sales for the brick-and-mortar division. But when you look at the e-commerce segment, they absolutely killed it. Despite their maturity in that segment, e-commerce sales were up a whopping 66.9%. That caught us by surprise, that caught analysts by surprise, especially when you look back at the first quarter. They saw e-commerce sales up just 31.7%, and that first quarter included about 7 weeks of pandemic buying. And again, Duluth Trading Company was best known as an e-commerce site before their foray into brick and mortar. As such, e-commerce growth rates historically haven't seen the same jumps as other apparel companies who kind of backbuilt their e-commerce presence, maybe some of those more legacy apparel companies. Their stellar quarter for e-commerce for Duluth led to an overall increase in sales by 12.6% year over year. New buyer growth, so they're bringing in those new customers, of 54.6% versus last year. That was the number the company was probably most excited about, it sounded like on the call. And a gross profit increase of 11.8%. All of this showed up in the bottom line. As we discussed, they beat analyst expectations, but they also improved their net income by $4 million over last year's second quarter, total of $1.9 million. So basically tripling their net income year over year. Now, when they talked about their e-commerce success on the call, they credited this to a number of internal and external factors. Good to see, by the way, a company crediting success to external factors that don't necessarily have to do directly with the pandemic, because a lot of times we hear external factors get blamed for poor sales but not credited for good sales. Duluth was pretty fair in terms of looking at what drove those e-commerce sales. New buyer growth, as we noted, that was immense in the quarter, particularly among women. Women's apparel is a category that Duluth has been pursuing now for the last few years. And sales growth in women's still lags sales growth in men's. For this last quarter, for example, 9.6% sales growth for women's apparel, 15.3% growth for men's apparel. Still, this gap is narrowing from what it was a few years ago, and they are seeing an increase in the total number of consumers purchasing women's apparel as it pertains to those new customers that are coming in. Another reason for the e-commerce increase was their momentum in markets they have a brick-and-mortar store for. Their thesis is, and always has been, I say always really the last 10 years, that their brand and customer engagement is strongest in markets where they have a physical presence. Nowhere was that clearer than in this quarter, where e-commerce sales increased by about 21% more for store markets versus non-store markets. So by the numbers, what that looks like, e-commerce growth was 79.8% year over year for markets in which they have a store, 58.6%, still good, just not in-store market numbers for the growth for markets that don't have a store. Still, that's not enough to lift sales in the store-based markets above where we saw it last year. With the stores closed for the first part of the quarter, overall sales for the markets where they have a brick-and-mortar store did decrease slightly in the 2% range. And you can see there, brick-and-mortar is still a very big traffic driver. It's still a very big revenue driver for the company. And when they don't have those stores open, the company does hurt. An external factor that made that impact, and this is kind of something that they referenced for the quarter, the increased endeavors for U.S. residents to venture outside for their vacations during the summer. Typical gathering places, you think about summer gathering places like zoos, museums, event centers, so forth. A lot of them are closed. So many, to borrow from REI, have opted outside. And so far in Labor Day weekend, we're only about a day and a half into Labor Day weekend here, that's been very evident in where I live in Colorado Springs. The local hikes are busier perhaps than they have ever been. I've seen more traffic on some of the local trails than I have ever seen. So I've had to go deeper into the mountains, so to speak, to kind of get away from the tourists flocking to the Colorado area. So this, combined with a spring and summer assortment for Duluth Trading Company that was geared towards the outdoors customer, that all parlayed itself into strong e-commerce seasonal sales. Now, one final reason they gave for the increased e-commerce sales was their advertising spend mix. Duluth's marketing spend has always exceeded that of their peers as a percentage of sales, and sometimes exceeding that by a big number. They've always been a big believer in traditional media, and traditional media oftentimes costs the most, especially television. But we've seen a shift there. They've begun to shift more of their spend towards digital advertising. Part of this is due to the fact that with physical stores closed, they want to underscore and make kind of a one-click conversion, if you will, their existing app-based and online options. Their marketing shift resulted in a 130% lift in new customer growth in e-commerce. That's a pretty substantial ROI if you're looking at it from that. All of this while their marketing spend deleveraged as a result of increased revenue and reduced overall dollar costs from cutting back on those TV ads. They also cut back on the catalogs that they produce a bit. And now you're looking at a very reasonable 8.1% of net sales for advertising versus 13.4% at this time last year. Still a little bit ahead of a lot of apparel retailers who sit around 4 to 5%. And of course, every apparel retailer is slightly different there. But Duluth is always going to be a company, it seems like, that will spend on marketing. But they've managed to get that in check while also developing that new customer base. And while it was mostly good news on the sales front, the pandemic has impacted Duluth's short-term expansion plans. They came into the year wanting to expand their store base once again by about 10 to 20%, but now they plan on opening just 4 stores for the year. So we've seen that brick and mortar growth slow because of the pandemic. In fact, the entire span of the second quarter saw no new store openings as a result of the pandemic. No new store openings during a quarter has been ultra rare for Duluth since becoming a publicly traded company. They went from March 5th to August 14th without opening a store. Now, the reduction in store openings and other infrastructure projects means the company will be spending about $15 million less than planned on capital projects. That's about a 50% decrease from plans at the beginning of the year. Now, we should keep in mind when we're talking about that, that Duluth has largely been a cautious company as it pertains to growth. I think a lot of people could look at that and say, well, Duluth sees danger on the horizon. If they're curtailing that expansion, they don't see a purpose to the brick and mortar stores. I think that's a little bit contrary to what they were saying on the earnings call. They said brick and mortar is still very important for them. But when you look at their history as a company, despite all of these openings of new stores, they've avoided the typical habit of maybe newly public companies or VC-backed companies to take on massive amounts of debt in exchange for breakneck growth. Their growth has been much more in line with what you've seen from Indochino, to point at another brand. Rather than growth for the sake of growth, it's been steady and sustainable for both of these companies. Therefore, it should surprise nobody that they're curtailing CapEx during this time, despite their profitability. And you look at their balance sheet, it's comparatively healthy. They have $17 million more in cash and cash equivalents now on their balance sheet than they had at the start of the fiscal year in February. Now, one other possible item of concern is their inventory levels, which increased greater than did sales in the first 6 months of the year and is now up 46% year over year. Given how much the company talked about the sell-through of spring and summer seasonal, which we alluded to earlier, this kind of caught us off guard a bit when we got to the inventory portion of the call. They did reference the sell-through for certain other categories lagging somewhat. This resulted in necessary markdowns for these categories and subsequent advertising efforts to move those markdowns. All of this resulted in a bit of a ding on gross margin, but they did note that their end-of-season inventory, end-of-summer meaning, is still higher than what they deem ideal. This doesn't mean their seasonal inventory position. Again, we talked about some of their summer seasonal selection selling through pretty well. It's just where their inventory is at the moment. All that said, they expect their inventory to fall back into line at the conclusion of the fourth quarter. One final note, and this has to do with our looking ahead, actually, from a few weeks ago. The strain on shipping systems has resulted in some potential roadblocks for the company, given that their e-commerce mix is tilted so much compared to other retailers. You know, even other fashion retailers might see 25% of their sales coming in via e-commerce channels. That's not the case for Duluth. Their percentage sales through this channel is much higher. As a result, you're seeing higher costs, higher delivery times for customers, especially when USPS is used, and also sharp cost increases because of the increased traffic. UPS, and that's Duluth's primary shipper, place daily allocations on Duluth Trading Company that are below Duluth's forecasted needs. So that's led to peak charges that the company calls steep, and that's only going to get worse if they continue to increase their sales into the third and fourth quarters. And again, as we talked about, as we see kind of a deterioration of the U.S. Postal Service, you wonder how much strain UPS and FedEx will be under as we head into the holiday season. I know Layton actually had a package lost via USPS, and this last week called a representative and they said, yeah, it's probably lost forever. You're going to need to resend that. And he asked him how common this was, and they indicated that it was extremely common. So that's not a good sign for people that are ordering e-commerce products and having it shipped through the Postal Service. Now, part of their plan going forward, Duluth's plan that is seeking alternatives to traditional shipping. Also heavily encouraging customers as much as they can online in their store markets to pick those products up in store. Dave Loretta, the company's CFO, actually said on the call that it could mean about 100 to 200 basis points when he was asked by an analyst of added costs to ensure that they come through on shipping promises, because one thing they don't want to have happen is promise shipment by a certain date or promise expedient shipment only to have the third party carrier, who they have nothing to do with, so to speak, deliver it way late or not deliver it at all. So they're trying to keep everyone happy, but overall, they did not sound at all confident in the future ability of their shipping partners, whether it be the Postal Service, whether it be UPS or whoever, to be able to deliver packages in the quantity they need and on time. That's the key. If they delivered fewer packages, they could probably work with UPS to get everything delivered on time. That's not good for e-commerce retailers that don't have their own shipping network. So Amazon, Walmart, Target, they're going to be in the catbird seat as you head into the holiday season because they can really control their own supply chain to a greater extent than companies like Duluth that are relying on third parties to fulfill. So again, Duluth's trying to push as many as possible to buy online, pick up in store, but with a limited brick and mortar footprint, that could be difficult for them and is certainly something to watch for them in the third and fourth quarter. Well, that'll do it for the news segment of the Retail Focus podcast for this week. Coming up, we'll be joined by Chief Creative Officer Mike Welsh of Mobiquity. We're going to talk about strategy in terms of creation of not only loyalty programs, but also app development for major convenience store chains and some of the thoughts that go in there. One of the interesting things we'll touch on, it's not always the typical consumer you're thinking about. They've got fleet customers to think about as well. So lots of different facets covered in this interview. Loyalty is always a hot topic in retail. We hear it time and again. Loyal customers spend more, visit more, and are attracted to your brand more than customers that don't have that loyalty. All of this makes perfect logical sense, and we constantly hear about how retailers like Ulta Beauty or Kroger or Target drive participation in loyalty programs. But what about the convenience store space? After all, we're seeing the space get more and more crowded as regional C-store retailers expand their borders and become more national C-store retailers. To that end, we're pleased to be joined by Mike Welsh, the Chief Creative Officer at Mobiquity, to discuss how some convenience stores drive loyalty through tying apps in with their existing loyalty programs. Mobiquity counts among its clients, by the way, Come & Go and Wawa, two thriving and major C-store players. Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Great. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
First, just so that our listeners kind of know the perspective that you bring, I was wondering if you could explain a bit about Mobiquity and your role at Mobiquity on the day-to-day.
Sure. So Mobiquity's been around since 2011. We started as a company with its DNA based in mobile. In our early days, we sort of saw that mobile was going to be the next wave. And as apps started to pick up, the app store started to grow, the expectations and things that people wanted to do with mobile grew as well. And as soon as it became less of a fad and the sort of early, late majority started to pick up, businesses started to see this as an enterprise opportunity for their operations. And specifically, our company spends most of its time trying to help companies make better business decisions. We're sort of a magical combination, if you will, of strategy, technology, and design. And when you think about the Wawa or K&G experiences, they're based on a premise that's built around a person. What does an actual person do? If a convenience store transaction is roughly 90 seconds, you've got 90 seconds to figure out how to build your brand, have your customers become loyal, and deliver on the promise that you have from a value proposition standpoint. And we try to help companies deliver on those promises.
So as you kind of referenced, mobile apps have really become the norm increasingly rather than the exception or rather than some sort of novelty in all spaces, but the convenience store space over the last 5 years in particular. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the transformation that's occurred and is still very much occurring in terms of tying in digital facets to maybe loyalty programs that were existing pre-mobile app.
Sure. It's a good question. You know, companies have sort of taken the slow, fast follower, a lot of risk aversion early on in making these kinds of investments. So loyalty programs where you've got a card that you scan when you walk into the store, or you know, maybe you started a barcode scan at the pump. There's a number of different scenarios that companies tried to start to begin to do the adoption in a sort of digital frame. What we saw early on was companies like a Wawa or a C-store or QSR were trying to figure out a way to capitalize on it. So early days, it was Panera, it was Wawa. How do you actually make the transition and the jump from people coming into the store during busy times, making orders, lots of lines pile up? So it became sort of an operational efficiency play. Can we get people to order ahead? And we'll relieve a lot of the day part busyness that you'd see at a Panera, say at lunchtime, and or a Wawa. And the idea became a foothold if you could tie it to loyalty. So lots of consulting firms would come out and say, hey, create your best earn and burn program, build up your currency of points or whatever it is, you know, a la Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts, and then have people come and do redemption. The issue is that's not going to be enough. These companies saw order ahead, made to order sandwiches, you know, fuel activation, for example, at K&G, being able to operate the pumps. All that kind of stuff is on people's roadmaps. And with COVID, you know, sort of accelerated because people don't want to go to these stores anymore, order ahead becomes super critical. So if you tie that in with loyalty, you can steer wallets in different directions than you could in the past, and you could do it more efficiently.
I think that's really interesting that it kind of started as an efficiency play, cutting down the amount of time people were spending in the store, increasing that throughput, and then it very much started to tie into loyalty. And I wanted to kind of jump off of that because every convenience store, every company that you assist there at Mobiquity is obviously different. And you mentioned as much of it comes from the strategy end of things as anything else. What are some considerations that you have to take into account when you're first starting to work with a business regarding development of an app?
There's a couple of things. That's a good place to sort of jump off. The typical enterprise looks at their sort of business model and says, okay, am I just cannibalizing the people that normally are foot traffic in my store if I build an app? And we get this argument a lot of times from companies, sort of financial, you know, departments saying, look, I'm just spending money to get customers and I don't need to spend that money because they're always going to come to my store, which is a belief that we feel like is sort of it's an old belief, right? You build a store, you know how much money that store produces. If you say, I'm going to take, in the Wawa example, they have kiosks, four of them in every store. People have to walk in and put their sandwich order in by tapping the screens. If that's the only place that people can put orders in, you've got a throughput problem if you want to access more and more of the marketplace. When we say, what do you have to do as a company? You have to think about how big you want your business to be, because you're going to basically put that kiosk in everybody's pocket. And now not 20 people in the store, but 1.2 million people in the marketplace all can do order ahead. How do you prepare a business for that? And that's daunting because you have to look at your operation. You have to look at your sort of lower end systems. You have to look at your SAPs, your ERPs. You have to thread the needle through that whole stack and bring it back to an experience that a person goes, hey, if you can't do it as smooth as Amazon or Uber or any other next act that you have on your phone, then I'm not interested. I won't download it. It won't be sticky and I won't keep it. So one of the things we tell companies is you got to have a sort of value proposition that makes sense in the space. And then you have to have at least a little bit of fortitude, intestinal fortitude, to go off and build a hardened infrastructure that can support that. Just like you would for the store, just like you would for fuel pumps, just like you would for anything else, the grocery, center of store stuff, all that has to be considered now because now it'll all be available on the phone.
So that's an interesting point you make, because ultimately it becomes about not only offering the service via phone app, but also delivering on that, making sure you're not over-promising and under-delivering. You've got people waiting, that type of thing. I was wondering, outside of efficiency, outside of, you know, turning on a pump, for example, what are some other ways that you've noticed in which app-based engagement by a customer shifts the way in which they interact with a convenience store?
Right. Really, really good question. So typical convenience store is set up with day parts. And day parts is sort of their busy times of day. So you've got your breakfast, coffee sort of thing that happens in the morning. People come in, get gas, go in and grab a coffee. You have the midday, which is sort of, you know, your typical, hey, everybody's coming in for lunch, or, you know, people are arriving at the store and they've got parking and you're going in and placing your order. Well, that's a traditional model now. That's almost like a legacy model. Think of it that way. Now people are using the store as almost a mini distribution center for their stuff. So they don't want to go into the store unless they're going in for a purpose to get in and get out. So that 90-second transaction model I talked about, we did the research up front for a while and we figured out that's typically the 90-second window. And now you can shorten that, which has lots of knock-on effects. If you figure that the consumer is going to do all the work, self-service, which is something that people want, which is also fits the convenience model, like what's more convenient than you doing it yourself? You have your reasons and favorites. You don't have to go into a terminal in a store that doesn't remember you. You now have a mobile app that has everything you ordered for the last week. The people are using these stores differently because they've now got their own personalization. The company has done a great job of doing their own personalization. How do I personalize the experience for you? So now you're talking about sort of audience and wallet steering that a convenience store never really thought about. We just go build more stores. We'll build another store down the street. It turns out that you don't need more stores. The first thing you shouldn't think about as a convenience store is, or convenience play is, I got to go build another place. What you have to think about is, how can I extend my reach against those digital properties that I'm competing with? Because again, there's convenience stores everywhere. And so you can choose. There's no loyalty per se. It's what's convenient. And so what's more convenient is make more of the features available in the experience. Drive it by understanding the human experience, what people really want. It's a little bit of Maslow and a little bit of operational efficiency on top of that brand promise you have. And then I think you've got a recipe for success.
So you just mentioned one of the key plays with an app is the fact that it is remembering your favorites. It is remembering your last order in terms of food. As you go into developing and working with the companies to develop these apps, obviously some C-stores, some businesses aren't going to be as food-oriented as others. So what are some different features or facets outside of maybe just ordering food? We mentioned contactless fuel pay as well, that you've kind of been able to roll into these apps that have seen a benefit for both the store and the consumer.
Yes. If you think of the tiered rewards type of program where instead of just you getting the sort of standard earn and burn of a couponing type of experience, what if there are ways that you could unlock other opportunities? For example, companies offer retail rewards for fuel consumption. So if you fill up, maybe I give you discounts on food or vice versa. Eligible purchases cause you to have a discount at the pump that you're surprised and delighted by because I'll light up your phone when you begin to fuel. If you use the phone to activate, I can actually tell you a story about how your behavior within my convenience store translates into savings in different ways. The other piece is, if you think about how you keep a customer and their lifetime value growing, you have to make sure that they can do most of this stuff themselves. So think of Amazon Go, right? You've got the Go store checkout. The concept of an unmanned convenience store, you know, can be shocking for somebody. But for a lot of our clients, they're starting to see the benefits of some customers are going to do grab and go. I'm just going to walk in. I'm going to get my sandwich order ahead, but I'm going to grab a bag of chips. I'm going to scan it with my phone and then I'm going to leave. And so the concept of what's the relationship from a store associate standpoint, which is a part of the brand pillar that most of these companies have, that store associate knows your name. It's sort of Cheers, right? You walk into the same convenience stores, everybody eats the same stuff, and you get a relationship build out of that. But what if you could have that relationship still exist, but I'm just doing the transaction myself? Or I have a coffee subscription that I just go in and I draw down and buy coffee futures. If you're a fleet buyer, if a fleet comes in and uses these convenience stores because it's on their route from, you know, New Jersey to Florida, what if you could actually manage the fleet relationship so that there could be benefit for those folks that are using that store? So again, there's a lot of ways that a company can actually use these programs, build them into the experience, and sort of maximize the personalization, wallet steering, and a loyalty standard that says, in the past, it was always act, you know, put coupons in your phone, and then watch what this consumer does. In the future, it's got to be about watching what consumers do. So do behavioral analytics. Do some of the stuff that's been done in advertising for years and do retargeting and do all that kind of stuff and then act, because then you don't have redemption problems. You don't have achievement issues. You don't have all the kinds of things that typical loyalty programs struggle with in over redemption or fail to convert. You do it based on what observable behavior you have. So the app becomes a resource for that.
That's fantastic insight. And one of the things you mentioned is also offering aspects of the app, aspects of loyalty programs and the like for fleet customers as well. What are some of the different considerations that go into developing that part of the process? Because convenience stores aren't only serving the people that are running in for a sandwich and chips. As you mentioned, they've got other customers, fleet customers as well, that they have to think about.
Yeah. And we do these brainstorms for the clients. You know, we do sort of quarterly business updates and we give them trends and sort of here's what you have to think of next, not just road mapping, because that's sort of a thing of the past. Companies are continuously integrating and continuously deploying features all the time. Every week, you know, it would seem that Wawa has a new feature, new tweak, a new something. So conceptually, if you're a fleet customer, think about what curbside means to a fleet business where people have to come in. You've got your employees now using features that were once just the bastion of the consumer. If you rethought catering, for example, if a convenience store sells food and they're putting trays together and they're building that stuff, fleet customers potentially can benefit from some of that because they can get for a whole crew, for example. You run a landscaping company. You send your whole crew in. There's 6 trucks, 8 tractors. All of them have to get filled with fuel. So you negotiate that, put that in a private label experience. And now I've got a way to, as a business, financially track my fleet usage. And a convenience store play has a way to contract in a sort of more meaningful way with that company, giving them a tool so they can do fuel pay across, you know, a fleet. Let's say they have 1,000 people and they're all out there doing work. Those 1,000 people load the app on there. they get the benefit of personalized rewards, but the fleet owner gets the benefit of controlled pricing, tracking usage. You know, they get the receipts already, even from an expense perspective. You cut down on all of that, which gives the efficiency back to the fleet owner and gives some lock-in to the convenience store play.
One of the things we mentioned was the contactless fuel pay, and I know that's been a big feature for KNG customers of late. I was wondering, just for people that haven't been to the Mobiquity website, maybe they don't live in a market where a KNG exists, if you could explain just a little bit about how that process works for the customer, if I were a customer going fueling up there.
Sure. So the sort of first model is you walk up, and COVID, you got to get out and touch that pump, right? And you're not going to do, you have to touch the pump with putting in your zip code. You have to touch the fuel type that you want. You have to grab the handle. So there's at least three or four touch points, or take out your card and stick it in the dispenser. And what if the dispenser has like some fraudulent skimmer in it or something like that? So what we said was, what if we could rethink all of that and say, you pull up, it's raining out. You don't want to touch any of this stuff. You got kids in the car. If I just pull out the phone and identify what pump I'm at, you know, first download the app, get the payment vehicle set up. So you put your card in or something like that. All that stuff locked in the app securely. And you say, I'm at pump 10 and I hit the button within 90 seconds or a little bit more. The pump activates, you hear the beep, and you can get out and touch the pump one time and put it in your vehicle and pump. Now, in some cases with COVID-19, the associates are coming out and they're waiting and they'll actually come out and pump it for you. So you don't even have to get out of the car, for example. Now in Jersey, of course, that's the law in New Jersey. But if you can come in and activate, you don't have to give anybody a card. You don't have to give anybody any sort of information. You don't have to touch the keypad. Don't have to do your card. Don't even have to do the contactless bit where you walk up with your phone over the little NFC reader. You don't even have to do that. Just stay in your car, authorize the pump you're at, get out, pump it, get back in your car, drive away. And to some extent, you can get rewards part of that. There's a reward piece. There's sort of retail rollbacks that we've done where you can actually use that as a trigger for a reward opportunity. Or a surprise and delight, somebody comes out with your favorite drink from your recents and favorites. So you can imagine a completely different experience at the pump where fuel side becomes an opportunity to deliver that brand promise. Hey, I got your coffee that you ordered yesterday. We thought we'd give it to you. And that's a way of translating that reward into a physical interaction with that brand ambassador who's the associate that you know.
It's kind of like bringing the New Jersey and Oregon experience to the rest of the country.
Exactly. Right. 100%.
So we'll finish up on this. What do you see is next for convenience store loyalty apps? Where are we going here? What do companies ultimately want to do with this going forward? And what are some developments on the horizon?
Yeah, it's a good question. So when you think about the landscape that's out there, as technology evolves, you can start to see, like, the COVID thing we'll look at as sort of a quote unquote temporary thing. However, there is more desire for consumers today than there ever has been in, you know, recent memory to make the experience on their phone act as a remote control for the environments they go into. They don't want to deal with associates. They don't want to deal with people. People just want to go in. And again, in the interest of convenience, they want to go in, have their interaction and leave, but don't make the fact of I'm transacting currency, I'm tendering my credit card. I just want my phone to know that I'm here. And if I walk in, I want to be known as a customer now. And then I want to be able to check out the way I want to check out. And again, to some extent, the technologies that are out there, you know, QR codes were not cool for a while, but now that they're built into the operating systems, QR codes are cool again. And so if you're at a pump and you scan something, you could actually drive an order right from the pump by just scanning a sticker. And so the idea here is there's a number of technologies that are coming out or that are out and becoming more available that allow for unmanned stores, the concept of in-app delivery, in-app purchases, potential subscriptions. So I could subscribe to the coffee club, for example, or I could buy maybe fuel futures. So if I travel a lot for work because I'm a drug rep, I might want to actually have paid for lock-in pricing for 2 weeks. Like, there's a lot of opportunity out there for fleets, for when we think about mobile ordering and made to order. So menu authoring becomes a thing. What if I could automatically have all the orders and things ready, all the stuff shipped to the store, and cut down on my labor costs? One of the things that we're exploring with some of our clients is, you know, for every 30 seconds of delay caused by an experience in the store with an associate, that could introduce millions of dollars in labor costs across a whole system. So could you make a more integrated associate experience, like hook an Alexa up in the back room, and then you as an associate can have interactions with Alexa? the idea is that if there is a need for a cleanup out front because there's a fuel spill, what if there was a way for you to ask Alexa to tell somebody to do something? So the idea of integrating voice in the future of these operations is key for them to become more and more efficient. If you run out of certain foods, for example, if you have to lock them out of the system and that shuts them down from the menu, you can do that in a much more surgical way and be more precise about how you do that. That little tiny bit of precision can translate into tens of millions of dollars at the bottom line. As companies, anybody that hears this, think forward of the opportunities, but don't ignore the legacy systems that you have. Somebody paid for those systems. You just can't throw them in the trash. So there's got to be a solid balance of how do I transform the enterprise at the same time deliver value to the consumer and not sort of burn down the house in the process. And there's lots and lots of different ways to do that to make efficient use of funds.
Such an exciting space. And I feel like we're going to see so many developments here over the next 5 years, as many as we've seen over the previous 5 years. Well, once again, Mike Welsh, the Chief Creative Officer of Mobiquity, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
No, thanks so much for having me. It's a good topic.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, once again, we thank Mike for joining us here on the podcast. That was a fantastic interview with lots of great insights from the C-store industry, and we hope to continue to look at the C-store space further on down the line as we continue to roll forward with the Retail Focus podcast in 2020. Now, our looking ahead story this week, if you weren't watching retail news carefully, you probably missed it. But Giant Eagle debuted a cashierless store, and like others, like the Amazon Go stores, like the 7-Eleven stores that have been rolled out to this point, they're looking at a convenience store size for this particular store. It's 3,000 square feet, and it's in the Pittsburgh metro area. Giant Eagle partnered with Grab and Go, which is a tech company. And again, not a full-line grocery store, as has been typical of most of these cashierless operations so far. But, and this is the looking ahead part, they expect to deploy the technology in one of their full-size stores of about 100,000 square feet by early 2021. Just as an aside, Circle K is on deck to launch a cashierless store next year. Now, the reason I'm looking ahead at this launch by Giant Eagle into a full-line store is, how exactly do you implement it? Because it's not reasonable, certainly, to expect the stores to operate like an Amazon Go store would, where the store is cashless or the store doesn't have any cashier options whatsoever. This is going to be more of a cashierless option for those who wish to use it, and it'll be interesting to see how they deploy it, because again, as we've talked about on the show before, it's all well and good to say, hey, this convenience store is completely cashierless, but a lot of markets, even with the COVID-19 pandemic going on, require retailers to accept cash, although some of them have rolled back the laws at least temporarily during the pandemic. But also you run against a situation where you really do have a digital and technical divide. Not everyone has what are known today as phones, but used to be known 5-10 years ago as smartphones, with that app capability. And not everyone knows how to operate those. You would be surprised at the number of people that don't have email addresses, don't interact with technology on that level. So while you have a couple of generations that are very bullish about using this technology, you have many, including some of the population that would be most likely to use a regular grocery store, that either don't have the technical literacy to work these apps and work these options, or they don't have the technology in hand to be able to do so. So again, it's kind of interesting how it's going to be laid out and formatted. There's a lot of things that I'm going to be looking at here. Grab and Go's technology, again, it's coming from a company that has a great pedigree. The co-founder actually of Pandora is the head of it. They have a ton of just incredibly intelligent staff on hand, as a lot of those tech companies do. So that's what I'm going to be looking at. How does this work on the rollout? What are some facets to it that make it work in a 100,000 square foot store where we've only seen it in convenience stores to this point? And moreover, how does it differentiate itself from the scan and go technology that other retailers have the likes of Kroger. Because again, if you're looking at just, okay, hey, I'm going to pick up an item, I don't have to scan it with my phone and it'll check out as I leave. How much more convenient is that for the consumer? Will the consumer care about that technology? I'll be interested to see also usage rates over the next couple of years in this Giant Eagle store. I think on the balance, it's a great thing for stores to embrace this technology. But overall, I do think we need to keep in mind that, hey, it's not always just about the best and greatest technology, because you have to meet your customers where you are. In grocery retail, that includes a number of different facets, as we've talked about time and again on this show. So that's my looking ahead story for this week. How is Giant Eagle going to conquer this particular mountain? Coming up on the show next week, we'll be joined by Danny Cushion of Cardlytics. Cardlytics has released their most recent state of spend reports, which they're doing monthly during the course of the pandemic. But we'll talk to her about that. Not only that, but also Prime Day. The effect that Prime Day being bumped back to early October will have on holiday spend. Will holiday sales kick off well before Halloween? And to what extent will holiday sales be flattened across the final 3 months of the year this year? They've got a lot of great data to back up their talking points, Cardlytics does. And again, you're looking at purchase data from over a billion transactions in the U.S. yearly. Truly some of the biggest pools of data that you will see. So we'll be happy to have her back on the show next week. That show will launch next weekend. Well, once again, for Leighton Behind the Scenes, I'm Trent Kling saying so long until the next episode.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.